Welcome to Profiles. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest is poet Richard Newman. Richard, glad to have you with us.
Thanks for having me here.
You're very welcome. Richard, I understand that you grew up in southern Indiana. Tell me a little bit about where you grew up and what it was like.
I grew up around Evansville, Indiana, which, as we know, is kind of in the toe jam of the boot that we know of as being Indiana. And I left there to go to college in 1984, and I haven't really been back too much since. It's kind of a love-hate relationship with my hometown. I love it a whole lot when I'm not there.
So did you grow up out in the country or in town? Or?
I grew up in town, but most of my family is from rural areas in Indiana and Illinois, southern Illinois, southern Indiana.
Where'd you go off to college?
I went to St. Louis, Washington University. I tried coming back to Evansville after I graduated from college, and we started up the old band. I've played in rock bands much of my life. I wasted probably all my 20s and even some of my 30s playing in rock bands. And it occurred to us that there were a lot more places to play and a lot more opportunities in St. Louis than there were in Evansville, Indiana. So we moved the band to St. Louis. So I didn't get too far.
Well, what moved you from rock and roll to poetry?
It certainly wasn't the romance. I don't know. Neither one are particularly romantic. It's very easy to romanticize the rock and roll lifestyle, but from my point of view, there was not very much romantic about it. We basically schlepped around from town to town, making sometimes $50 and all the beer we could drink, and sleeping on strangers' cat-infested floors, and I'm violently allergic to cats, so that wasn't particularly romantic either. But it's a lot of hard work with not much reward, so I hopped into a field like poetry, which is also a lot of hard work without a whole lot of rewards. But I think one of the things that appealed to me about the poetry is I could stand or fall just on my own, just me and the page, as opposed to in rock and roll, being dependent on three or four other guys in your band to show up to rehearsals or even to show up to the gig or booking agents or club managers or publicity. And so much of it has to do with people outside of you at a collaborative or a business aspect. Mm-hmm. So I was drawn to poetry.
Did you write lyrics when you were a full-time rock and roller?
I did. I wrote the words, the songs, the music. I played guitar and sang. I still write a song every now and then, one will slip out, but I consider myself retired.
You, if I understand correctly, did your MFA at Spalding in a low residency program. Could you explain a little bit about what's that like and what took you back to school to actually study poetry once you were drawn into it?
Yeah, well, I put off getting an MFA for a long time, until my mid-30s, actually. I had edited a magazine called River Styx Magazine, which is a literary magazine. I could make twice what I was making doing the exact same thing, teaching at the community college, if I had an MFA. And also, I thought it would be a great way to work on my next book or books with some poets who I admire. For example, Richard Cecil, who's here in Bloomington, and Molly Peacock, who'd been one of my favorite poets ever since I was an undergrad, both of whom wrote unabashedly formal, but also moving poetry, which is what I wanted to do. So I thought, you know, who better to have as editors of your book than Richard and Molly? So that was why I went to Spalding. It's a low residency program, which means you don't have to go to the campus and live there 24/7. You can go there twice a year for little week periods, and then the rest of the time you work one-on-one with a mentor or a teacher, correspondence-wise, by email or sending packets through the regular mail. So it was a perfect way for me to get my MFA degree and not have to transplant myself from my home and my job and my family and my daughter and all that stuff.
So what was your experience like as you became a more and more serious poet? Because I'm guessing that happened along the way. Maybe I'm wrong.
No, and actually I don't think I was any more or less serious when I was focusing more exclusively on it in an MFA program. I've always been both serious but not serious as a writer. My work is both serious and not serious. I try to skirt the line between humor and sorrow, tragicomedy almost. So it's hard to take yourself too seriously being a funny poet. But I'd been doing that for a long time anyway, And I guess as far as getting my first full-length collection out, I kept beating my head against the wall, being a finalist in poetry contests, but never winning. I think one year I was beaten out 5 times by Asian American women writers writing poems in English as a second language. 5 times in 1 year. And I thought, geez, can you imagine how good their poems would be if they were writing in their original language? So it was one of those kind of deals. I just felt like I was unconnected to the poetry business and the publishing business, despite being an editor of a magazine. So I thought I would just sit down and work exclusively on a book.
And did you give up teaching during that time in editing, or were you?
No, I didn't have to. Because I did what I basically do anyway, is I write. But I didn't write so much in terms of shaping a book. And that's what my mentors in an MFA program did for me, is they helped me shape the book as a book.
And that book is Borrowed Towns.
You know, Molly Peacock had a lot to do with shaping it. Because I told her the story, you know, how many times I'd been beaten out in poetry contests, always being a finalist. Probably 20 to 25 contests I was a finalist. So I was very frustrated at the time, and I was getting closer and closer to 40, and I'm thinking, all I have are these little chapbooks, but how am I going to get a first full-length poetry book out? So she said, well, give me your books, because I had like 3 piled up by that time, and I'll tell you why. And she read them, and she called me from Toronto. That's where she lives now. And she said, I read your books. I can tell you exactly why they're not getting published.
Why?
Yeah, that's the question, right? Tell me why. She said, well, I like them very much, but they're too bleak, they're too gray, they're too dreary, they're too Midwestern, and they're too alcoholic. And I thought, that sounds like a great book. Where can I buy one? And she said, you might think it's a great book, but nobody's going to choose that for a first prize. So what she did is she took some poems from the second book, some of the sunnier poems about my daughter or domestic life, and she sunnied it up, as she liked to say.
Isn't that interesting?
So she sprinkled some of the nicer, I guess, more tender poems, the less alcoholic poems, the less gray, bleak, dreary Midwestern poems. She sprinkled those through. She sunnied it up, and the very next place I sent it, took it.
Amazing.
Go figure.
What do you mean by it's too Midwestern?
I guess when you're entering national contests, I guess they want more of a broader perspective than just a Midwestern perspective? I'm not sure.
I guess I'm trying to understand what a Midwestern perspective would include exactly. If you contrasted it with a coastal perspective or a southern perspective, what are the traits?
I don't know. That's a good question, because I always felt like I was unabashedly a Midwestern writer. I mean, my favorite poet is Robert Frost, and I think he made his terrain, you know, north of Boston area, that he made that his. He owns that. And I wanted to do something similar with southern Indiana, southern Illinois, where I'm from. So to me, that was a good thing. But and Molly said, well, maybe that is a good thing as far as your voice goes, but nobody's going to choose that for a first book prize. They want something, I suppose, more universal. I don't know. I'm not a book editor. I'm a magazine editor.
Well, I'm going to ask you a little bit more about how you combine writing, editing, and teaching. But before that, I'd love to hear one of your poems, maybe one of those that capture the Midwest. Do you have one that you'd like to pick especially?
Well, why don't we do Crossing Schlinsker Ditch?
Okay.
That captures southern Indiana, where I'm from, as well as, I think, a lot of Midwestern themes. There are a couple things about this poem that people might be interested in knowing. There's a reference to North by Northwest, the Hitchcock movie with Cary Grant, and there's that famous scene of the crop duster plane chasing mm-hmm. him over the cornfields. So I stuck that in here. And then there's also a reference to Santa Claus Land, which I think they now have moved and called Holiday World.
Right,
but it's in
Santa Claus, Indiana,
right,
if I'm correct.
Right. But the story that initiated this poem is my daughter Natalie and I were driving to Evansville for Thanksgiving, and she looked around through the southern Illinois, the kind of bleak, brown, flat cornfields, and she said, Daddy, did you really grow up around here? And I said, yeah. And she said, is this why you are the way you are? And I said, yeah. So I had to get the feeling of that in a poem somewhere. So here we have Crossing Schlinsker Ditch. Between Schlinsker Ditch and Bosch Ditch on 41 South, between brown fields where, in north by northwest, the crop duster chased Cary Grant over brittle corn stubble, where rusty fences slouch drunkenly into a gray horizon, a scrawl of trees. Home is a land that offers no return. Hitchcock picked it for its stunning bleakness. Even the long band of blackbirds, thick as gnats and stretching over 100 acres, reluctantly touches down here and there to pick through a few splintered kernels, then slowly billows over the highway, south, to leave this area so lost, so lacking monuments, the people name the ditches. The only populations that increase are cemetery, prison, and hog factory. A few miles north, Santa Claus land crumbles back to meadow. Barns collapse slow motion. Abandoned trailers snooze along dirt roads. My young daughter and I also migrate for the holiday, muttering our thanks we no longer live here in Gibson County, picking over a dead bird's bones. Picking through the best of my childhood, as we leave with boxes of books and games, a few pictures, a tuneless ukulele. And as we finally head back home, due west, returning to this land who knows when, the wind finds a small opening in the car, its long finger pricking under my skin.
Thank you, Richard. Thanks for that reading. Tell me a little bit about yourself as a writer, your writing process. You know, you said before that it was you and the page together.
Yeah, it's a solo act, I suppose. And I like that much better than the collaborative aspect of playing in a band or theater. Playwriting is also a collaborative act. Not because I want all the glory, because I don't like depending on other people for a work to succeed or fail. If I succeed or fail, it's because of me. I consider my peers, my favorite writers, that's the ones who I write to. So I try to aim to that level of writing. My favorite poets, say Frost or Larkin or Bishop or Hardy. But I expect to fail. I think it's important to take the risks. But I fail as me and because of my own shortcomings, as opposed to some guy forgetting to show up to rehearsal or being too drunk to play the gig or whatever.
So are you one of those very disciplined writers? Do you write X amount of hours each day, or do you work out of exercises? Do you work out of inspiration? I mean, where do you pull your ideas from?
Well, lately I've been so busy teaching that I haven't had a chance to write as much as I'd like. There's the term adjunctivitis. Do you know that? Like being an adjunct. Adjunctivitis.
Got it.
Yeah. I got it bad. So I'm teaching 5 different classes at 4 different places. So I eat my lunch on Highway I-70 in between campuses, and I have a class every hour almost. So I don't have a lot of time to write. When I am in writing mode, yeah, I'm very disciplined, which always amazes my friends because the rest of my life is so discombobulated and unorganized. But my writing life is very disciplined. I usually write every morning. When I'm writing, when I have time, I usually give myself 45 minutes a day. It's easy. It's manageable. The hardest thing about writing, as you know, I'm sure yourself as a writer, it's starting, right? Making the time to sit down and do it. So 45 minutes a day is bite-sized. You can do that. It's digestible. So sit down 45 minutes. If you're on a roll or in a groove, it almost always turns into more than 45 minutes. So it ended up working just fine for me. That's how I worked on my poems in the MFA program, or before that, collecting the poems for my books.
We asked you to pick out a few songs of your favorite music, and one of those that you selected is Ventilator Blues by the Rolling Stones, which is off of Exiles on Main Street.
Mm-hmm.
Why that piece?
Oh, I just always love that guitar riff. I mean, that guitar riff gets under my skin. I have several guitars still. It's a holdover from when I was doing the music days, and I tuned one of them to the Delta Blues tuning, which is what the Stones usually use. It's kind of a cockamamie open G tuning. So I love playing that as well. But it's just a great riff, and it's a great song, and some kind of ventilator is going to come down and get you. What could be better than that?
We've just been listening to Ventilator Blues by The Stones off of Exiles on Main Street. Our guest on Profiles is Richard Newman. Richard, in the last couple of years, I guess, or maybe in the last year, you've had your poems recognized by Garrison Keillor, by Billy Collins for Best American Poetry. How does, you talked before about always being, you know, always being a runner up. How does it be, how does it feel to be getting that kind of recognition?
Well, it was funny because almost all that happened in 1 month. So I had like one really good month and an otherwise pretty bleak career. That's kind of how it happens, isn't it? It's all or nothing. But yeah, it was great. I've always admired Garrison Keillor's storytelling. In fact, I think my poems are the poems of a failed storyteller. I'm a storyteller by nature, by impulse. You know, I love to make people laugh. I love story arcs, but I don't have the patience to write fiction. My fiction is terrible. So basically my poems are compressed stories, extended metaphors compressed to, you know, a sonnet form, 14 lines. So yeah, when Garrison Keillor read my poem, even though he made Firefly is a divorce poem, sound like it was set not in St. Louis, Missouri, but in Lake Wobegon. It was still great to hear.
And also having another poem chosen, the suitcase poem, which I'm not saying title correct, for the Best American Poetry.
Oh, the Briefcase of Sorrow?
The suitcase poem. That was good. The Briefcase of Sorrow.
You're close. Satchels, briefcase, suitcase, gym bag.
And so that was chosen for, to be, and it's just coming out in?
Yeah, I think it just came out. I got my copies already, so I assume that the rest of the world has theirs.
Well, congratulations on both of those.
Yeah, thanks. I've long been a fan of Billy Collins, and I can see why he chose that poem. It seems like a poem that would be right up his alley.
Because?
Because it's funny, because it's silly, because it takes a small little device and riffs off of it to exploit all the silliness, wring all the silliness out of it, or funniness. But at the same time, I think it has something serious to say as well.
Tell me a little bit about what you bring into your teaching, and how you balance your, or don't balance your, adjunctivitis, as you call it, being an adjunct professor. I guess you're teaching in various places, WashU and a few other places.
Yeah, St. Louis Community College, St. Louis College of Pharmacy, oddly enough, where more than half of my students are potheads, and that seems to be their main source of material for writing essays, is smoking pot or their bongs or what they've named their bongs. I've never seen anything like it. I'm not teaching pharmacy. I'm teaching composition at the College of Pharmacy. I didn't think I'd end up there either, but, you know, you take what you can get.
So you're teaching not just poetry, but you're teaching creative writing, composition,
right?
The old standard 131 course.
Yeah, pretty much. Or I guess Comp 101. I vowed that I wouldn't teach composition again, but I needed the extra money this semester, so I am doing a composition class. Hopefully, I won't have to again. I remember now exactly why I don't do it, because I put a lot into my teaching, even something like composition. I'll stay up until 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning grading papers. I'm sure I spend a lot more time on their papers than they did. So it affects my writing.
When you teach, are you teaching any creative writing courses?
I do. I teach a poetry writing class, and I teach a class called Poems and Plays, which is a literature class, but I have them write poems as well in there. And then one of my favorite classes, we have this program in St. Louis called Oasis. It's for senior retired adults. Well, it's this wonderful program, and that is my favorite class, hands down. I'm sure that none of my pharmacy students would be listening, and they have their feelings hurt. But Yeah, it's people that are older, adults, 55 and up, and they write, and we have workshops. And some of my best writers are in that class. I mean, they're so interested in doing it. This is something that usually they've wanted to do all their lives, and now they get a chance to do, so they listen to everything I say. They suck up everything I tell them, bring them exercises and examples, and they just eat it up. It's wonderful. And there are three or four in that class that I think are writing really good publishable work as well. They're too afraid to send it out, but they are, and that's the important thing.
How do you break down teaching writing? I mean, do you read a lot of things in your class and bring that in? Do you use exercises? Are you a structured teacher? How do you, you know, when you think about teaching art, I think it's always a little bit tricky in that sense. What do you bring into your classes?
I kind of take a survey of the class, kind of gauge the class's needs and bring in what I think will help the people in that class, or what they're interested in, or what they need to know the most. For example, the Oasis classes, once we started one semester, it turns out they were all interested in narrative, whether it was narrative poetry, narrative in fiction, or memoirs. So we just did the whole semester exploring narrative, how to tell a story. And then in the next semester, I brought in, on a whim, a villanelle and a triolet, which is another kind of repetitive form, and a sestina, and they'd never seen anything like it. So we spent the whole semester doing repetitive forms, the old French and Italian forms of poetry. So it's just kind of a common denominator, what they seem most excited about, and what they're most excited about then in turn excites me. With the poetry classes in the undergraduate level, we'll teach out of an anthology, and then I'll bring in things to supplement that based on what they need or what they're interested in or what turns them on.
Do you find that it affects the way you write? Like if you're teaching a certain style, or you're concentrating on narrative, or you're concentrating on a certain form, that your own work ends up being affected by that?
Not so much, although what I'm interested in at the time is going to infect the class. Say, for example, if I discover some poets that I'm excited about, I will bring them to the class. Or if there's a kind of poetry that I'm interested in at the time, I'll be bringing that to the class just to try some ideas out loud.
Well, let's take a moment to listen to another piece that you picked out, another piece of music, which is by Big Star, and you're going to have to tell us who that is. And the name of the song is Oh My Soul, and it's off of the album Radio City. Who is Big Star, and why pick this song?
Oh, Big Star is one of my favorite bands. They're a band from Memphis. They were playing in the 70s. It's Alex Chilton's first band where he was writing his own work. Alex Chilton, as you might know, was in the Box Tops, The Letter.
Late 60s,
Was it late 60s? I don't remember. But yeah, when he sang that song, even that sounds like a gravelly old guy, he was 15, I think, when he recorded that song. So he finally got a chance to do his own work with Big Star, and they made some of the finest pop albums ever, influencing everybody from REM to Replacements, the whole alternative indie type rock.
We've been listening to Oh My Soul by Big Star from Radio City, and you're listening to Profiles on WFIU. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest is poet Richard Newman. Richard, you're also editor of River Styx, which is a very well-known, small but very well-known literary magazine. Talk to me a little bit about what editing entails.
Not a lot of pay, a lot of work. That's basically it. Minutia and repetition, that's basically the regimen of an editor. We receive probably 350 stories a month, and we're mostly known as a poetry magazine, so we receive probably between 2,000 and 3,000 poems a month, And that's not including our poetry contest. So everybody wants to be published. And few people want to subscribe. So that's always the ongoing battle.
So when you, how do you deal with that kind of quantity of writing?
Well, when I took over the magazine, it wasn't quite so big. The magazine's been around for, this will be our 33rd season. When I took over 12 years ago, the magazine had just about gone under. In fact, they hadn't published anything in a year and a half. So I resuscitated it, rebuilt it. And so we didn't receive as many submissions back then. Now, you know, you get in Best American Poetry or New Stories from the South or Pushcart or any of those anthologies. People see you. People start, you know, they want their work to be in there as well. So you get a barrage of submissions. But now that we're bigger, we have some staff people volunteer. There's not a lot of fat in poetry to live off of. So, yeah, we have a volunteer staff of other editors that people are interested in reading submissions. So I don't have to read it all anymore.
How do you winnow down from 2,000 poems to how many do you publish, 20 or 30?
For an issue?
Yeah.
Yeah, about 20 or 30 for an issue.
How do you, I mean, what are your decisions based on? Where do you make first cuts, second cuts, third cuts?
Yeah, that's the hard thing. And the thing that makes it even harder is I would characterize about 80% of the submissions being competent. Mediocre, you know, they're okay. They might be a little flat as far as language is concerned, or the ending might not quite work, but they're competent. And then maybe 5% is god-awful, and then another 5% is really, really good. And it seems like we spend a lot of our time sifting through the 80% that's competent or mediocre. It might be, you know, some talented writers that, you know, weren't particularly inspired or not their best work, or, you know, some pretty good work by some young writers. They're just out of an MFA mm-hmm. program or in an MFA program.
What makes something stand out as being really good? What are some of the things that jump off the page for you?
Well, to me, I think what I like, especially the older I get, is I have increasingly less and less patience with a lack of clarity. I'm so tired of obscure poetry. And poetry that I don't even know what the poem is about after having read it two or three times, or poems that measure the various gradations of light. I just don't care about that anymore. So I like something that is clearly about something that's also something, a topic or a subject or a theme that's moving to me. An original voice I like also. I like a poem that's surprising, where I don't know where it's going to go, but then once it has gone there, it seems inevitable. I like poems that are funny. So we publish, in fact, our next issue is going to be a humor issue, kind of a tragicomedy issue. Maybe taking a springboard from that famous Mark Twain quote that goes, "The secret source of humor is not joy, but sorrow. There is no laughter in heaven." Well, that kind of characterizes what my approach to writing my own poetry as well. So you could probably say that almost all the issues of River Styx or could be described by that Mark Twain quote, but this one is unabashedly so. We're sticking it on the inside cover.
Well, let me ask you. This is a good time for you to read another poem, and I'm going to ask you if you would read Cyclops, because I'm not sure exactly why. But when I was reading Borrowed Towns, your book of poetry, for some reason that one jumped off the page at me.
Well, you know, I'm glad, because I don't think I've ever read this publicly, and no one ever published this. There are like three or four poems in this book, Borrowed Towns, that nobody wanted, that were unpublished, and some of those are my favorite poems, and Cyclops is one of them too. So I'm glad you like it, and I'm glad you asked me to read it. So here is a chance to debut Cyclops. You know, this is from a series of monster sonnets that I started writing and couldn't stop, and finally had to make myself stop writing these monster sonnets. And some of the monster sonnets, you know, they're kind of lonely, mutant-type people, like Mothra and Bigfoot. You know, they're monsters. And this is a monster I felt especially bad for because no one wanted it in a literary magazine, but I stuck it in the book anyway. So here's Cyclops. I used to think the world was really flat, that your second eye gave an illusion of depth, a nymph near or far, and my one eye wept, And what's the difference between grabbing a fat U and a cloud? I held them all in my palm. Now, of course, I know the world is dark, the fiery eye of the sun a snuffed spark. The dance of color and shape has been embalmed in memory and steeped in black skies for this dark passage in which I fumble and creep. I hear the scuttle of mouse bones in my cave. The flutter of bats tells me when to sleep, while a murder of crows outside tells me to rise. I wash in rocky echoes of the waves.
I don't know if it's the, you know, the murder of crows, which is one of my favorite ways of looking at animals. You know, that phrase is
right.
Just such a rich phrase.
It
or
is.
The cave and the mouse bones in the caves, or the notion of the world being flat and that you shift things by shifting perspective. But I just really like that piece.
Yeah. Well, I always kind of did too, even though it's not one of the funnier monster sonnets. Most of them are kind of funny. I don't know what I was thinking when I sat down to write that one too. I just, every day I would sit down and write a monster sonnet, and everyone was from obviously the point of view of that monster. So that's what happened with the Cyclops.
When you work on something, how long, or not how long in time, but how long in process does it take you to get from a first draft to what feels like a publishable copy? And what is the process of moving that along?
It really depends on the individual poem for me. Sometimes you get lucky and you get it right the first time. Like the poem we talked about earlier, Briefcase of Sorrow,
mm-hmm.
That was inspired by a quote from the anthology I teach from. It's a book called The Discovery of Poetry, and Francis Mays, who edited that, has a little section with rules what not to do when you're a poet. And so I had to go and break one of those rules immediately. And as soon as I was done with class, I went to my office and I wrote the first draft of that poem, which is almost exactly like the final version. That almost never happens. And then the fact that that got in Best American Poetry this year made me think maybe all my poems should be the first drafts, and everything I anguish over for a year and a half I should have just thrown away to begin with. But yeah, sometimes it'll take, what, it's not uncommon to have 20, 30 drafts restructuring things.
And do you divide writing up into different parts? I mean, I often think about, you know, the gathering piece, which comes from reading or walking or, you know, journaling, wherever it may come from.
Sure. The initial inspiration.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then a revising piece, which is a whole different method, and an editing piece, which is another difference that comes in. Do you sort of have a structured divide when you're working on things?
I don't know if I have a structured divide, but I do have modes that I'm in at the time. So you asked me what my writing process is like, and I say I haven't had time to write. Well, that's kind of a lie. I haven't been writing new work, and that takes a lot of time, but it's a different kind of time than revision. So what I've been doing lately is I've been revising poems for my next book, and I'll go over those in the morning. I have a little reading group that we send each other poems, I guess, the last Friday of every month, and then we all respond by the next Wednesday. And those comments have been very helpful. Like, I wonder if I can get away with this. And then Wednesday said, nope, couldn't get away with that. So I've been in revision mode lately, mm-hmm. going over and over things. Poems that I thought were done that turned out weren't quite as done as I'd hoped.
And does your next book have a theme at all, or is it just a process of moving forward into a new stage of
writing? It has several themes. And so far, I'm still happy with it, which doesn't always happen. But it's, right now, the working title is Domestic Fugues. And a fugue, I don't know if you know this from your music terminology, is a form of music with lots of repetitious phrases, or mm-hmm. Repeating phrases. And it also means, if you look it up, it's a state of mind in which you perform actions almost like an unconscious state, which upon waking up you have no recollection of having performed those actions. And it struck me as like, what a great metaphor for marriage. Like my first marriage was a total failure. And I finished, when we finally finished the long drawn out process of divorce, I thought, how did I do this? How did I get here? I didn't even remember loving the person that I had just divorced and spent all this time with and even made a baby with. So the whole idea of being in a state of fugue, you can be in a state of fugue, struck me as particularly apt for domestic themes. So there are a lot of domestic poems, and they also are in a fugue form with repeating or recurring lines, or lines repeating musically or obsessively in the poem. Memory poems, I think, tend to be obsessive. So I have obsessive repeating lines. Also kind of playing on words a little bit, like a feud, domestic feud, but in this case a fugue. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the themes.
You sound excited about it.
It's been fun. It's been fun. I'm always telling stories, whether I like it or not. And I've forced myself to heighten the lyricism of my poems, the lyrical aspects more, and not just tell a story, but to play with the music of the language mm-hmm. more.
Well, and isn't that one of the things that differentiate poetry and prose?
Of course it is, yeah. And I've always been fascinated with the overlap between song and story, which are my two biggest impulses, to sing a song or to tell a story. But I've been trying to combine those as much as I can, telling a story but in very song with very song-like structures.
Well, let's listen to one of the great storytellers in song, Neil Young.
Very much so.
And this is Powderfinger off of Off Rust Never Sleeps. And tell me a little bit about why you chose Powderfinger, not one of the best-known songs of Neil Young.
Well, it should be. I love the opening of this song. In fact, my daughter loves Neil Young also. In fact, she loves The Stones and Big Star as well. She'll make fun of me because I listened to the beginning of that. Look out, Mama, there's a white boat coming up the river. I mean, I'll listen to that opening two bars over and over again. Because I love it. But it tells a great story. I mean, talk about the overlap between story and song. I think Neil Young does it all in Powderfinger. Plus, those guitar breaks are heartbreaking.
Look out, Mama, there's a white boat.
You're listening to Profiles on WFIU, and we've just been listening to Neil Young in his song Powderfinger from Rust Never Sleeps. Our guest on Profiles is poet Richard Newman. Richard, you mentioned we were talking about the crossover between story and song. And, of course, song for years was the way that people told – I mean, one of the ways in which people told stories, there's a very rich oral tradition in poetry – is part of that. Where do you see as an editor and as a teacher and as a writer, where do you see some of the lines between the oral telling of stories and the written word?
Well, it's always squirting around. I mean, the trick is maybe to find that line. And that's what I've been enjoying looking for in what I've been working on as my next book, or which I hope becomes a next book, is that line between story and song. I think it's two of our most basic primal instincts, a love of story and love of song.
Do you think there's a lot of talk because of the internet, the rise of the internet, and because of access to work on the internet that the print version of things is going away? And there's, you know, that argument between, no, we're actually having a boom in books and it's disappearing because of people's ability to communicate over the web. What do you think about that?
I don't worry about that. I hate reading stuff on the computer screen, despite the fact that I spend so much time on it. But most of the time I spend on the computer is emailing friends, which is, of course, the best way for a writer to procrastinate, is emailing friends, right? But I hate reading anything longer than a page on a computer screen. I like to read in bed, frankly, horizontal. And I'll be damned if I take my computer to bed with me. So I'm not worried about that at all. But then most of the things I like tend to be obsolete or something else very few people even know about or like or care about. Favorite bands like Big Star. I mean, a handful of people know them, but boy, they're passionate.
What are some of your favorite books? You've mentioned a few of your favorite poets, Robert Frost, Elizabeth Bishop, Molly Peacock.
Mm-hmm. Philip Larkin, Thomas Hardy. I love Thomas Hardy. The older I get, the more I like Philip Larkin. And I think I fell in love with Larkin's work when I was an undergraduate, but I like it even more now. So he and Frost, depending on what mood I'm in, tend to be my favorites, but they trade off or fight for that top honor somewhere in my head. Fiction? I do enjoy reading fiction. And when my daughter and I still have bedtime story every night.
How old is your daughter?
She's 11. And she tells me that she will never give up bedtime story, even when she's in college. I'm not sure how we're going to work that out. But we read fun things. You know, we started out reading The Chronicles of Narnia years ago, and that struck some nerve in her. So, you know, we moved on to The Lord of the Rings last year, all three of those. And then we just discovered the Golden Compass series. Have you read those?
Yeah, one of my daughter's favorites.
Yeah, I couldn't believe how good that was. I was so skeptical. I like it so much that I think that I might have to not see the movie.
I didn't know there was a movie.
Yeah, they are making a movie of it. And my daughter and I both feel that when we love books, we don't want to see the movie because we like the way that it is in our heads as opposed to on the screen. So, yeah, my tastes range from you know, kids' books, kids' novels, to some of my favorite novelists. John Hawkes, I always like. Robert Penn Warren, I reread All the King's Men, which I still think is the greatest American novel. Friends of mine, Rachel Klein, just wrote a novel that I really liked, too. I met her at a Swanee Writers program, and I liked her, so I'll give her novel a try. So, yeah, I read widely and variously.
Let me ask you to share one more of your poems. You mentioned Suitcase of Sorrows. That one was chosen by Billy Collins for 2006 Best American Poetry.
Sure, this is A Briefcase of Sorrow. This has a little epigraph from Frances Mays, from her anthology, The Discovery of Poetry. And it goes, "Some writers get into the habit of letting of name a metaphor without really showing the image to the reader. Sea of life, mattress of the soul, river of death, or, perhaps the worst, briefcase of sorrow. And me, being the cantankerous person that I am, as soon as I read that, I had to go and write a poem using of to name a metaphor without really showing the image to the reader. So, briefcase of sorrow. My briefcase of sorrow slumps by the door. This semester's done. I leave it behind, all my manila folders of grief, stacked and alphabetized, bound with rubber bands of stretched hope, pens of overachievement, and pencils of petty angst. At some point, I suppose I should dump its insides out on the table, the staple remover of apocalypse, a few sticky notes of indecision. Poor briefcase, it can't ingest them, try as it may, and I should especially purge the gradebook of mixed endeavors, the crumbs of last month's sandwich. Not now. My neighborhood pub calls louder than some cloying briefcase, strap of pity wagging as I leave, its two bright buckles of expectation gleaming for my return, once again, when I will spill its contents, the paper clips of despair, the wet naps of desire, bringing it, light and swinging, along my side to fill one more time its compartment of everything and nothing."
Thank you. Richard, what keeps you writing?
I couldn't imagine not doing it. It's what I do. I like to tell stories, and I like the music of language. I like to make people laugh. I like making myself laugh. I like funny things. So I couldn't imagine not doing it.
You've been listening to Profiles on WFIU. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest has been Richard Newman. Richard, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Shauna. I had a great time.
The program you just heard was recorded in October of 2006. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Emily McCord was our research assistant. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.